covenants, the legal and ethical implications. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel, for the introduction. And thank you, Professor Nigel Cameron, for this very honorable invitation and for giving me the opportunity to speak to you on this fascinating topic of biopolicy. The organizers emphasize the pace of science and technology that raise more and more questions for human rights, human life, and existence, as the flyer says in the introductory paragraph. I can only agree with that. I am myself engaged in coping with the intellectual challenges which are posed by this today. I'm working on two levels, one the bioethical research, including also social science approaches, philosophical approaches, but also empirical in the sense of qualitative research, and on the political advice level in this advisory body for the Swiss government. And I'm also thinking about how they too can relate to each other and with the world in the real society. What I want to present to you this afternoon are just a few reflections about the legal and ethical implications that might be important to think about in our societies. It's not just regulation, not just political pragmatics, which is needed, but it's also a discussion about the deeper transformations in the way we look at ourselves and at others as embodied beings, at our corporeality, as a modern philosophical term tries to catch it, corporeality, the reality that we are as bodies who live our body. At this never understood ambiguity of being a body, an organism which is an object with cells and molecules and which is at the same time a subject, a thinking, a me, a self, a sensible feeling body that can touch and be touched, that interrelates with others and explains itself within this relationship. We are these object subjects that biology describes and that biotechnologies promise to mend and even improve. We see this life, which is investigated by the life sciences, as participants in life. And this makes the challenge, the philosophical challenge of these questions, and makes these questions so fascinating. I start with an artist, Helen Chadwick. She enables us with these two objects to discuss these perception issues on cells, embryos, bodies, lives. Helen Chadwick died in 1996, and this is one of our last works she did. She was an intern artist in residence at King's College Reproductive Medicine Unit at that time, and asked parents who were in vitro fertilization treatment for permission to take photographs of some of their embryos. And these photographs, she combined this in such objects. The one to the left she named monstrance, which is a laden term, of course, goes back to the Catholic ritual. The one to the right she calls opal, which is a precious stone. And the whole work is called stilled lives, lives that can be looked at when they are stilled, came to a standstill. Because these embryos, actually, when they were photographed, were no more living. They were fixed in some chemical. But nevertheless, these photographs are fascinating to look at. Because, I can go a little bit closer to the left, because you see this difference. The embryos, they which are shown, they are all individuals in some way. And they are in an own way beautiful. They are not these drawings we know from the biology textbooks, which are just sketches. These are full of real life. We can even go a little bit closer. And what I think we can learn from this artistic approach is that perception is part of the game. In art, perception is itself a topic. It's not just a means to see something, but art presents or makes us perceive in new way and makes us think about perception. Normally, we don't see embryos around when we discuss about them. And stem cells, they relate to embryos. We cannot avoid this discussion. We normally see newspaper photographs, but newspapers, they use the photographs normally just as a eye-catcher or a symbol for announcing, oh yes, this goes into the chapter embryo discussion. Or we know them from representations that we construct from theoretical ideas we have. Ideas about what is a cell, what is a chromosome or a genome. But we don't see them as we see other people. The irregularities, perhaps, were to that. IVF doctors told me that the morphological irregularities do not refer to chromosomal aberrations. So irregularities are difficult to understand, already from a biological point of view. And these little beaming cell clusters are, in a proper way, beautiful. They are in some way related to what we are as bodies. But it would be too short to say we were those things, because this implies that we know what the term we means. I don't think that the embryos are a I or a self. What we think or we perceive that we are, this is a result from from many different processes that came mostly afterwards. We are not our chromosomes, you know. The self which is thinking is not the chromosomes thinking. The chromosomes are already there, of course. But still, these beaming, beautiful things are in some kind bodies. Bodies to be shared, donated, biobanked, cultivated, transplanted, and they can give rise to a new human life like ourselves. This is clear. I want to point out one important role I see for bioethics with this example. I think in bioethics it is important to open two tight conventions in understanding and perceiving moral and ethical issues. So bioethics, or ethics in general, has very often the role to critically think back how our fixed concepts of ethical issues were organized. We don't really have the complete set of reasons to say what is around in the discussion today. These are the issues already. The issues, how we discuss them, are a result of complex processes of constructing them. And bioethics need to make that process of construction of the issues also transparent. So this is a relation that bioethics has, or ethics in general has, with this artistic approach. Also, she, Helen Chadwick, tries to make transparent how we perceive. Now, I want to go to another story, which is also closely connected to the stem cell topic. One buzzword is regenerative medicine. And I went to the internet when I prepared this talk, and I found a publication from last year, last August, published by the US Department of Health and Human Sciences with the title Regenerative Medicine. And with this wonderful mythological picture on the front, and the introduction makes a myth very prominent. These are the first sentences of this quite thick publication. The Greek titan Prometheus is a fitting symbol for regenerative medicine. As punishment for giving fire to humankind, Zeus ordered Prometheus chained to a rock and sent an eagle to eat his liver each day. However, Prometheus' liver was able to regenerate itself daily, enabling him to survive. The scientific researchers and medical doctors of today hope to make the legendary concept of regeneration into reality by developing therapies to restore lost, damaged, or aging cells and tissues in the human body. Ladies and gentlemen, is this a good vision for regenerative medicine? It said it's a symbol, a fitting symbol, the first line. Actually, it's more than a symbol, it's a myth, a whole story with a certain sense in it, a meaning. And we can critically ask, is this meaning really a vision, a desirable vision for medicine? If Prometheus is punished by being bound to this rock and the eagle ate his liver each day and the liver regenerated and this poor guy couldn't even die. So I'm not so sure whether this vision is in any positive way a vision for medicine. We don't want to prolong our suffering or our punishments. I think, I don't want to go into the criticism too long, but it signifies for me that bioethics has here something to do. Bioethics is perhaps too much concentrated on the embryo issue. It is an issue. We need to discuss it. But on the other side, the visions, they are nearly not discussed. There are, of course, the post-humanists or transhumanists around. They present us quite naive visions of living for 150 years or double, or of uploading our minds to computers and things like that. I don't believe in the reasonability of those visions. But also then, they need an answer. So the topic of visions is around. We should engage into it. And that even the US Department of Health does not find a better story to illustrate or to start such a high-profile publication that should explain regenerative medicine to a broader public is really a sign that this topic is under-discussed. Another story. This is a story from the real world. I was participating in the cloning negotiations at the United Nations 2001 to until 2005. And there I saw that sometimes a too tight definition of what is the ethical issue can even make international negotiations difficult or even to be blocked. You remember perhaps that there was a vote on 6th November 2003 in the 6th Committee at the UN, only with one vote differences, against banning reproductive and therapeutic cloning. I think for people outside this discussion, this was nearly not understandable, because the start was that the UN was asked to engage into a project of banning reproductive cloning, which was perceived as an attack to human dignity, as a danger for the children that would be produced, who would be disabled or ill if they live until birth, etc. So a serious issue, but still quite in the future. And the result of this first round of this discussion was a split of the UN, 80 to 79 votes. And no convention could be agreed on. The 58th General Assembly decided we stop the discussion, we take no action, and renegotiate the issue in 1 or 2 years. And then it was renegotiated at the next General Assembly. A new project was launched, not a convention which would be binding, but only a declaration on human cloning. And the result was then finally reached, 8th March of 2005, with a very open formulation which leaves quite much open for interpretation for all the member states. Member states are called upon to adopt all measures necessary to protect adequately human life in the application of life sciences. No cloning, no therapeutic cloning is in the wording. Member states are called upon to prohibit all forms of human cloning. Here comes, but all forms of human cloning, what does that include? Inasmuch as they are incompatible with human dignity and the protection of human life. So every country can interpret what is against human or incompatible with human dignity. Perhaps, I don't see really a clear message in this formulation. And also, the result was, when you look at the numbers, 84 in favor and 34 against, with 37 abstentions. When you take the abstentions and those against together, then you have not such a huge overweight of the positive votes. In an issue that was quite clear morally, from my point of view, others looked at it differently, of course. The message I take from this is not, as some of the participants said, and one of them, the United Kingdom representative, was quoted in the UN press release, quite a negative statement. The Assembly had missed an opportunity to adopt the convention because of the intransigence of those who were not prepared to recognize. So this is moralism. You are pointing to the others. You are to be blamed. I think we should learn different things from this. And it's not such an easy question to answer. Why did it not work to ban reproductive human cloning? Which were the real reasons, the reasons in behind? Were there factual reasons, political reasons, or reasons of different worldviews? What could be still the value of a non-binding declaration as a moral retreat position? Perhaps there is still a value there. And also then the implications of this broken down negotiation process at the UN, when the first attempt was taken to negotiate an agreement in bioethical matters at the level of the UN. This perhaps is an issue that we should look at. But the main message I take from this is that a too tight definition of the ethical issues can be an obstacle. And at another place, it reappeared, this too tight definition of moral issues. Perhaps you heard 2 years ago, stem cell scientists suggested a new procedure to go around the moral objections against therapeutic cloning. They suggested to genetically manipulate the embryo or the egg before it grows into an embryo, to the left, and then after stem cells are harvested from the embryo, to genetically manipulate them a second time for turning on a gene that was turned off at the outset. And this gene, CDX2, biologists call it, is an essential gene that is necessary for the embryo to develop. So without develop beyond the blastocyst stage, also beyond this stage where the stem cells can be harvested. From a technical point of view, it's understandable that somebody comes up with this proposal. And from the point of view of those who see the potential of an embryo to develop as the main reason for protecting the embryo, it is also clear when you take out this potential from the embryo, then it's not a entity to be protected anymore. But this is still the physics of altered nucleus transfer, and I'm sure there is also a metaphysics here in the background. When you look at the alternatives that would be around, particularly the second from below, a nuclear transfer, the normal procedure of therapeutic cloning, a nuclear transfer with a nucleus from a patient into a donated egg, develop into an 8-cell stage into a blastocyst, and take out the stem cells, but ban the implantation of this constructed embryo into a uterus. This would be a solution from the outside. And obviously, this solution, that was the object discussed at the UN, this solution could not convince. Why? The result would be the same. No growing cloned fetuses in wombs of women or cloned babies. But the difference is obvious. With this proposal of Jänisch and others on the lower line, with this double genetic manipulation where the potential is taken out from the genome, something internal was changed, which was perceived as something on the level of the essence of this embryo. But why is the genetic material the essence of the embryo? As a biologist, I have difficulties to understand that, really. Perhaps, again, a myth can be the explanation. We can put the question this way. Why is genomic alteration expected to silence ethical objections and the change of circumstances that are equally necessary for development is not? Why does this expectation even override concerns for added risk with this double genetic manipulation? Risks that would be important for the patients to be treated with the stem cells. And my hypothesis is, it concerns the underlying genomic metaphysics. If one assumes a genetic program, chromosomes, genes, the genome, composing a program how to develop the organism, the human being, then the conclusion is that destroying the program or altering the program in a way that development is no longer prescribed by that program also eliminates the ethically relevant potency of the embryo. Then this conclusion is logical. But it stands on the assumption that the genes are a genetic program. And if program metaphysics, I call it this way, program metaphysics is not taken for granted and alternative, probably scientifically more plausible, ontological accounts, I say ontological accounts, not scientific accounts, it's a philosophical level here, the ontology, the question of what makes this being a being. And these more plausible accounts are based on a systemic and contextual reading of the genetics and the genomes, and if we consider this, the conclusion would be arbitrary. So my criticism to this approach is that the strategy of legitimizing stem cell research via the altered nucleus transfer strategy assumes a strong but hidden metaphysical assumption and therefore fails, because this assumption is not really convincing anymore. Genetic program metaphysics is not the same as genetic determinism. Perhaps this is worth to explain. Genetic determinism is a claim that the genes determine all what we are, the color of the eyes and the intelligence and etc., everything. This is not a scientific position, because in biology, in genetics, it is clear that it's an interaction. The genes are important, but also environment is important. But the genetic program assumes something on a ontological level, on the level of what is the essence, what is that makes up the being of this being, independently from the question of how much the genes determine and how much the environment or nurture is determining. These are two levels that are separated. Now, let me go over to this process view of finding laws, regulations, of negotiating internationally, and this is the field of governance. First, I should explain how I understand the word governance. It's clearly not government. Governance is points to the fact or the manner of governing, and you can ask whether governance is a good governance or a bad governance, and this is then an ethical question or a moral term. Good governance is a moral term. In political science nowadays, governance is understood as an integrated approach to politics involving bottom-up approaches and top-down approaches and network approaches. So three directions, so to speak, of finding agreements or finding rules, finding norms in societies. The top-down approach is the classic government approach. A lawmaker discusses and finds a conclusion, and then it goes into law, and then everybody is supposed to act accordingly. This is the top-down approach. And the bottom-up approach is perhaps the direct democracy way, the grassroots approach, that people come together, they think we need to have these or those rules, and they propose it, and the upper levels in the political system, they take it up and make it into law. And then it is a law that had its origin from below. But the third level, this network level, is important because it points to what we are doing, for example, right now, in connecting to each other, in talking, in exchanging, in making connections between different fields, between different subgroups in society. All these networking initiatives. I went to Wikipedia for this. It's perhaps not the worst source, because if governance is about networking and cooperation, then the wiki approach, which is also a cooperative management of knowledge, is perhaps not a bad way of looking how this process of cooperative explanation of the word governance is actually understanding it. And there I found this quote. In general terms, governance occurs in three broad ways: through top-down methods that primarily involve governments and the state bureaucracy, through the use of marked mechanisms whereby market principles of competition serve to allocate resources while operating under government regulation? Perhaps an important thing to note that governance includes all bodies in society, also the companies. Normally in bioethics, we exclude these company level. And we think, oh, companies, they are just dangerous. They are interest-bound. They are, if they pay a conference, then you should not go to this conference because there is a conflict of interest, or things like that. But evidently, companies are a very important reality in our societies. And if we succeed in involving them properly into a cooperative way of finding rules, then I think we have done a very important thing. And the third is through networks involving public-private partnerships or with the collaborations of community organizations. Then I thought, what has this governance to do with my understanding of bioethics? Firstly, it has to do with it intrinsically, because bioethics is connected to governance. It's itself a practice within such cooperative networking initiatives. Bioethics is a communication engagement. I am talking to you. You are listening to me. Afterwards, I hope we have some discussion. So it's a way how we address each other in a very sensible area. Normally, bioethics has to do with moral issues. That's clear. Normally, we are sensible if somebody else, especially a foreigner, comes up and tells me what I should think in moral terms. We are quite sensible to that. So ethics and bioethics has to do with a very sensible field. Judith Butler has even asked the question, where is the boundary between ethics and violence? Communicative violence, she says. And the answers she gives in the Adorno lectures 3 years ago, that ethics needs a sensibility towards the processes, how we address each other, the structure of addressing each other, this relationship issue of addressing each other in these sensible issues. And I think she was right in proposing this as a topic. So, governance is connected to bioethics. But how could we try to explain what this moral term good governance is, and especially when it comes to stem cells? I have some preliminary answers, and I'm interested in hearing your response afterwards. First, we need a participation and involvement of epistemic communities, of communities who have experience, who share experience. For example, experience about diseases, families who are affected with these diseases, or people who have experience in hospitals, being affected themselves or having relatives. These are resources needed to understand what is really at stake in these ethical or bioethical issues. Second, avoid arbitrary decision-making by those holding power in their hands. This would be bad governance. And we need also a rule of law, how the decision-making processes should proceed. Then third point, transparency. This is a classical item in the governance discussion. Transparency is a high value for good governance, because otherwise vested interests and conflicting objectives of the participants would not be seen. Citizens who should find decisions legitimate need to know the reasons why they are taken this way. Fourth point, new developments in science and in the world should be integrated and possibly change an existing consensus. So the consensuses are not carved in stone, so to speak. Responsiveness of the systems might also be a positive value for good governance. Then consensus orientation, that allows of differences. Consensus does not mean we think all the same. We never will. I hope we never will. Otherwise we would end discussing. And I think the thing which is most interesting in this field is discussions and seeing how others look at things differently. There will be moral communities who disagree and who need to be recognized. No tyranny of the majority, for example, concerning the moral perception of the embryo. Perhaps this is the most sensible issue in this field and the most dangerous issue that consensus orientation does not or no more allow of differences. Then, two other points. Governance should have an interest for those at the margins of society or outside the system at all. Equity and inclusiveness. And finally, joint decision-making implies that bioethics has an integrated, not a theoretical, juridical role. So I take up a word of Margaret Urban Walker. Again, this theoretical, juridical role of bioethics means that bioethics is something up and has a view on moral issues, which is an expert view, and can then tell society what is really going on in morals, like a mathematician or a computer expert who really can tell me what is going on in my computer, and if I am intelligent, then I do what he or she recommends me. But bioethicists towards society are not the same than computer specialists to users of computers. Bioethics has an integrated role, but not a top-down outside role as a somebody who claims to see more in morality than normal people. Let's go back to the pictures of the beginning. I can only briefly discuss that. We saw that what this life is, that is living in the form of cells, is not so easy to understand. I want to raise a few Socratic questions to ourselves, also to myself. Do we really know what it is, life? Our life? Do we really know, can we really discuss or think about our own origins? My own origin. This difficulty, which is also a psychological difficulty, is important when we discuss questions like that. What is that, a zygote or a blastocyst? And obviously, the answer that we get from such photographs, which we all have in minds, and we think we know, yes, this is a blastocyst. Or we ask biology and they explain how many cells, how different those cells are, which genes are active, which are shut down, etc. The whole mechanism of an embryo. Obviously, this is not an answer, a real answer to the question of what is our life, or what is life of an embryo, not just seen as a system of functions, of molecules that interact. When it goes to corporeal life, to the life of the object-subject body, where a me, an I, a self has a room, obviously these answers from biology and medicine are not real answers. A psychotherapist last week, in a lecture in Lausanne that I attended, said, we have an overflow of language in a field where we lack words. We have too much answers that are, so to speak, answers, right answers to the wrong question. That made me think that perhaps the question of what is an embryo, what is life of a cell, of a plant, of a human being, is not answered by the best genomics and systems biology and the whole scientific approach. Perhaps I will give you a proposal to look at life also differently. Aristotle differentiated between two ways of being active. One way is called a praxis, practice, in the Greek word praxis, and the other way is in the Greek word poiesis, which is producing something. Poiesis is, for example, building a house where the result, where the result gives the sense of this practice. I want to produce something. In praxis, the sense of being active is being active, the activity itself. And the example he gives, Aristotle, is music playing, playing guitar. You don't produce something when you play guitar. You just play guitar. This is what you want to do. And from this, in a reading of Aristotle's biological writing, you can ask, is life on this side where processes find a sense, a meaning in being performed, not in producing something, in producing the next developmental step, but just in being there, in opening a presence or performing a presence? I leave you with that. I have two final slides. Some questions to the obvious situation which we have. We have different regulations in different countries. Perhaps two extremes with regard to stem cells. Germany, very tight, no use of any embryos for research. And on the other side in Europe, the UK, very liberal, nearly no restrictions before 2 weeks after fertilization. And we have many other countries in between, Switzerland, France, perhaps in the middle. Some ask, should we harmonize? Should we find a European solution? I ask, is perhaps difference also a value? Or is harmonization worth the effort? Because there are quite serious convictions behind these different solutions in Germany and the UK, for example. Some suggestions for discussion. Perhaps different regulations are also an opportunity for collecting experiences with different possible solutions and are a value in itself. And perhaps there is really no rational, true solution available. Despite the participants in the German discussion and the participants in the UK discussion, they each think that their solution is the right one. Culture and local histories influence sensibilities, and perhaps these issues cannot be discussed outside culture. Sometimes harmonization is necessary for pragmatic reasons, for example, for research collaboration, for example, in the Framework Programme 7. Recently, the European Group on Ethics issued a recommendation which are the minimal criteria of having a collectively funded research in the stem cell area in Europe. But a question stays. That leads me to the last slide. What about ethics? Can we accept this? Is this a defeat that different solutions are possible? In Enlightenment, ethics started with the assumption that there is a rational solution to moral questions, not a plurality of rational solutions. This is the last point I want to raise. Which role can bioethics play in biopolitics? Two levels, a formal level. Perhaps a good way of describing what bioethics can do is to be a reflective feedback loop in the process of innovation, of progress. A reflecting feedback loop that opens or defends occasions for discussion, for deliberation. This is not a top-down view. This is a view from inside, from the process itself. I don't believe in an Archimedean point in ethics that anchors moral principles outside society and outside history. It's more interpretation and interpretation and again interpretation. Substantially, bioethics has a role in opening a horizon of values and responsibility in a society where this is not always taken for granted, where interests are on the top. Values and responsibility for things, for actions, for structures, and also responsibility in relationships for people, for others. Bioethics has also a role in destabilizing the future, I take up a word of Nicholas Rose, by pointing to its contingency. Future is not an automatic process. We can influence it. It is contingent in that way that is open for participation. And we have some problems in our world that we need to solve and we to face it. And also, discussions need the right differentiations, and sometimes they need pragmatics. Sometimes the discussion, they lose the point which is really important, which are the really important problems in society to be solved. And a very philosophical question, what might make lives worth to be lived? That goes back to the myth of Prometheus. Was it that, a positive vision for regenerative medicine? Bioethics can also, this is perhaps paradoxical, can also contribute to overcome certain moralisms. Not all the issues are moral issues. And sometimes we get stuck into morality, so to speak. I think a level which is always going on is the procedural level. There is also a procedural ethics or procedural justice to be respected. And my conclusion is that bioethics has a role in biopolitics, has a role for each level of governance of these three roughly differentiated levels. And perhaps I have not found more points which would be important too. Thank you for your attention.